his gold ring had cut into the skin. "It's mine," Agnat said, stepping forward. I wasn't convinced that the book was hers. Agnat had come from a small village in Poland and could barely read signs, much less a novel. But she stood proudly in front of the guard, claiming the book, until she was dragged outside and whipped unconscious. I thought of my mother's advice to me when the Aussiedlung had begun. Be a mensch. Agnat was this, and more. Daria and I, along with Helena, the 15-year-old, were the ones who picked Agnat up and carried her back into the hut. We gave her some of our evening meal when she was unable to stand to get her own. Another woman who had been a nurse in her former life did the best she could to clean the open sores made by the lashes and to bandage them. We lived with lice and rats. We barely had water for washing. Agnat's cuts grew red and fierce, swollen with pus. At night she could not get comfortable. Tomorrow, Daria told her, we will take you to the hospital. No, Agnat insisted. If I go, I won't come back. The hospital was next to the crematoria. It was called the waiting room because of this. As I lay in the dark beside Agnat, I could feel the heat of the fever in her body. She grabbed my sleeve. Promise me, she said. But she did not finish her sentence. Or maybe she did, and I had already fallen asleep. The next morning, when the beast came in screaming at us, Daria and I ran to the toilets, as usual, and then lined up for appel. Agnat, however, was missing. The beast called her number twice, and then pointed at us. Find her, she demanded, and Daria and I went back into the hut. Maybe she is too sick to stand, Daria whispered, when we saw the outline of Agnat's form beneath the thin blanket. Agnat, I whispered, shaking her shoulder, you have to get up. She didn't move. Daria, I said, I think she's... I couldn't say it, because saying it would make it real. It was one thing to see the distant putrid smoke and guess at what was happening in those buildings. It was another to know that a dead woman had been pressed up against me the entire night. Daria leaned over and closed Agnat's eyes. Then she grabbed her arm, which was already stiffening. Don't just stand there, Daria muttered, and I leaned over the bunk and took Agnat's other arm. It was not hard to maneuver her down. She weighed next to nothing. We put her arms around our necks as if we were school chums posing for a photograph. Then we dragged Agnat's upright body between us to the courtyard so that it could still be counted. Because if the number was off even by one prisoner, they would start over again. We held her upright for the 2.5 hours of appel, as flies buzzed around her open eyes and mouth. Why is God doing this to us? I murmured. God's not doing anything to us, Daria said. It's the Germans. When the count was finished, we loaded Agnat's body into a cart with 10 other women who had died during the night in our block. I wondered what had become of the Dombrowska book, if some German soldier had confiscated and destroyed it, or if there was still room for beauty like that in a world that had come to this. Nothing grew in Auschwitz. No grass, no mushrooms, no weeds, no buttercups. The landscape was dusty and gray, a wasteland. I thought this every morning as I was marched to work, past the shacks that were the men's barracks, and past the incessant operation of the crematoria. Daria and I were lucky because we had been assigned to Canada. It was an area where the belongings that had come in on the trains were sorted. The valuables were tallied and given to the guards, who brought them to the SS officer in charge of getting them to Berlin. The clothing went somewhere else. And then there were the items that no one needed. Eyeglasses, prosthetic limbs, photographs. These were to be destroyed. The reason it was nicknamed Canada was that we all imagined that country as the land of plenty, and certainly that was what we saw every day as the suitcases piled up in the sheds with every new transport. In Canada, too, if a guard was looking the other way, it was possible to steal an extra pair of gloves, underwear, a hat. I hadn't been brave enough to do it yet, but the nights were turning cooler. It would be worth the risk of punishment, knowing I had a warm layer under this work dress. But that punishment, it was real, and it was serious. It was bad enough to have guards that watched over us, telling us to work faster and waving their guns. But the SS officer who was in charge of Canada also spent a portion of the day weaving among us as we worked to make sure we did not steal. He was a slight man, not much taller than I was. I had seen him drag outside a prisoner who had hidden a gold candlestick up the sleeve of her jacket. Although we did not see the beating, we could hear it. The prisoner was left unconscious in front of the barracks. The officer returned to walk through the aisles where we worked, with a nauseated look on his face. It made him seem human. And if he was human, how could he do this to us? Daria and I had talked about this. More likely he was upset he had to get his hands dirty. Besides, what do you care? She said with a shrug. All you need to know is that he is a monster. But there were all sorts of monsters. For years I had written of an Upjur, after all. But Upjori, they were the undead. There were monsters that took over the living, too. We had a neighbor in Łódź whose husband had been hospitalized, and by the time he came home, had forgotten the name of his wife and where he lived. He kicked the family's cat and swore like a sailor and seemed so radically different from the man she knew and loved that she called in a healer. The old woman who'd come to the house said there was nothing to be done. A dibuk, the soul of someone dead who would do whatever awful things it could in this new body that it hadn't been given time to do in its old one, had attached itself to the husband while he was at the hospital. He had been possessed, his mind usurped by a spirit with squatter's rights. Secretly, when the SS officer in charge of Canada passed by, I thought of him as Herr Dibuk, a human man, too weak to force out the evil that had taken up residence in him. "You are a silly, stupid girl," Daria said when I mentioned this to her one night, whispering in the bunk we shared. "Not everything is fiction, Minka." I did not believe her, because this camp, this horror, was exactly the sort of stuff no one would ever believe as fact. Take the Allies, for example. If they had heard of people being gassed, hundreds at a time, wouldn't they have already come to save us? Today I had been given a pair of scissors to cut up the linings of clothes. There was a pile of fur coats I was working my way through. Inside I sometimes found wedding bands, gold earrings, coins. And as I did, I turned them over to the guard. I wondered sometimes who had wound up with my boots, and how long it had been before she found the treasure hidden in the heels. There was always a little ripple of awareness when Herr Dybbuk arrived or departed, as if his presence was an electric shock. Even though I did not turn around to watch, I could hear him approaching with another SS soldier. They were speaking, and I eavesdropped on their German conversation as I ripped open a hem.
"So then, the beer hall? At 8. You won't tell me you're too busy again. I'm beginning to think you're avoiding your own brother."
Over my shoulder, I peeked. It was rare to hear two officers talking in such a friendly manner. Mostly they just yelled at each other the way they yelled at us. But these two, they were apparently related.
"I'll be there," Herr Dybbuk vowed, laughing.
He was talking to the SS officer who oversaw Appell, the man in charge of the women's camp, the one with the tremor in his hand. The one who was not inhabited by an evil spirit. He was just evil, period. He had ordered Agnat's beating, and ran hot and cold when it came to overseeing Appell. Either he seemed bored and the count went quickly, or he was on a rampage and took his fury out on us. Just that morning, he had raised his pistol and shot a girl who was too weak to stand upright. When the girl beside her jumped in response, he shot her too. These officers were related? There was a passing similarity, I suppose. They both had the same jaw, the same sandy hair. And tonight, after they had beaten and starved and demeaned us, they would go share a beer together. I had paused, thinking about this, and the guard who was watching me sift through the suitcases and satchels shouted at me to get to work. So I reached into the pile that never seemed to get any smaller and pulled out a leather valise. I tossed away a nightgown and some brassieres and underwear, a lace hat. There was a silk roll with a string of pearls. I called to the officer, who was smoking a cigarette and leaning against the wall of the shack, and handed it over to him to record and inventory. I lugged another piece of luggage out of the heap. This one I recognized. I suppose several people might have had the same overnight case as my father, but how many of those would have had the handle repaired with a length of wire, where it had broken after I used it years ago as part of a pretend fort to play in? I fell to my knees, turning my back on the guard, and opened the straps. Inside were the candlesticks that had come from my grandmother, wrapped carefully in my father's talus. Beneath that were his socks, his undershorts, a sweater that my mother had knit for him. He told me once that he hated it, that the sleeves were too long and the wool too itchy. But she had gone to so much trouble, how could he not pretend that he loved it more than anything? I could not catch my breath, could not move. No matter what Agnat had said, no matter what evidence I was confronted with daily as I marched past the crematoria and the long line of new arrivals waiting blindly to go inside, I had not believed my father was truly dead until I opened this suitcase. I was an orphan. I had nobody left in the world. With shaking hands, I took the talis, kissed it, and added it to the pile of trash. I set the candlesticks aside, thinking of my mother saying the prayer over them at Shabbat dinner. Then I lifted the sweater. My mother's hands had worked the needles, looped the yarn. My father had worn it over his heart. I couldn't let someone else wear this, someone who didn't know that every inch of it told a tale. This yarn lived up to its second meaning, a tale. with every knit and pearl part of the saga of my family. This sleeve was the one my mother had been working on when Basha fell down and hit her head on the corner of the piano bench and needed stitches at the hospital. This neckline was so tricky, she had asked for help from our housekeeper, who was a much more accomplished knitter. This hemline she had measured against my father's midsection, joking out loud that she had not meant to marry such a long-waisted gorilla of a man. There is a reason the word history has at its heart the narrative of one's life. I buried my face in the wool and started to sob, rocking back and forth, even though I knew I was going to attract the attention of the guards. My father had trusted me with the details of his death, and in the end, I was too late. Wiping my eyes, I started to pull the hem of the sweater so that the weave unraveled. I rolled the yarn up around my arm like a bandage, a tourniquet for a soul that was bleeding out. The guard closest to me approached, screaming, jerking his gun at my face. "Do it," I thought. "Take me too." I kept pulling on the yarn until it lay in a nest around me, crimped and rust-colored. Somewhere, Daria was probably watching me and too afraid for her own welfare to tell me to stop. But I couldn't. I was unraveling, too. The commotion attracted some of the other guards, who came over to see what was happening. When one leaned down to grab the candlesticks, I snatched them in one hand and then took the scissors I had used to cut up fur coats and opened their legs wide, pressing the blade against my throat. The Ukrainian guard laughed. Suddenly, a quiet voice spoke.
"What is going on here?"
The SS officer in charge of Canada pushed through the crowd. He towered over me, taking in the scene. The open suitcase, the sweater that I had destroyed, my white knuckles on the necks of the candlesticks. On his orders, just this morning, I had seen a prisoner hit so hard in the back with a truncheon that she vomited blood. That woman had refused to discard tefillin that were found in a suitcase. What I was doing, destroying property that the Germans believed was theirs, was much worse. I closed my eyes, waiting for the blow, welcoming it. Instead, I felt the officer pry the candlesticks out of my hands. When I opened my eyes, Herr Dibuk's face was only inches from mine. I could see the tick of a muscle in his cheek, the blonde stubble of his beard.
"Wem gehört dieser Koffer?"
"To whom does this suitcase belong?" "Meinem Vater," I murmured. The SS officer's eyes narrowed. He looked at me for a long moment, then turned to the other guards and shouted at them to stop staring. Finally, he glanced back at me.
"Get back to work," he said.
And a moment later, he was gone. I stopped counting the days. They all ran together, like chalk in the rain, shuffling from one side of the camp to the other, standing in line for a bowl of soup that was nothing more than hot water boiled with a turnip. I thought I had known hunger. I had no idea. Some girls would steal tins of food hidden in the suitcases, but I had not been brave enough yet. I would dream sometimes of the rolls my father made me, the cinnamon bursting on my tongue like gustatory fireworks. I would close my eyes and see a table groaning with the weight of Shabbat dinner, would taste the fatty, crisp skin of the chicken, which I used to peel from the bird when it came from the oven, even though my mother would swat at my hand and tell me to wait till it was on the table. Then, in my dreams, I would taste all these things, and they would turn to ash in my mouth. Not the ash of coals, but the ash that was shoveled from the crematoria day and night. I learned, too, how to survive. The best position for appel, when we lined up in rows of five, was in the middle, out of reach of SS guns and whips, yet close to other prisoners who could hold you up if you fainted. When lining up for food, halfway through the queue was best. The front of the line got served first, but what they were served was the watery bit that floated on top. If you could hold out to the middle of the line, you were more likely to get something nutritious. The guards and the capos were always vigilant to make sure we were not talking as we worked, or marched, or moved. It was only in the hut, at night, that we could speak freely. But as the days stretched into weeks, I found that it took too much energy to have a conversation anyway. Besides, what was there to say? If we spoke at all, it was of food. What we missed the most. Where in Poland you could find the finest hot chocolate, or the sweetest marzipan, or the richest petit fours. Sometimes when I would share a memory of a meal, I noticed the others listening. "It's because you don't just tell stories," Daria explained. "You paint with words." Maybe so, but that is the funny thing about paint. At the first cold splash of reality, it washes away, and the surface you are trying to cover is just as ugly as ever. Every morning, being marched to Canada, I would see Jews waiting in the groves until it was their turn at the crematoria. They were still wearing their clothes, and I wondered how long it might be before I found myself ripping the lining of that wool coat or digging into the pockets of those trousers. As I walked by, I kept my gaze trained on the ground. If I had been looking up, they would pity me, with my shaved head and my scarecrow body. If I had been looking up, they would see my face and know that what they were about to be told, that this shower was just a precaution before they were sent out to work, was a lie. If I had been looking up, I would have been tempted to shout out the truth, to tell them that the smell wasn't from a factory or kitchen, but from their own friends and relatives being incinerated. I would have started to scream, and maybe I would never have stopped. Some of the women prayed. I saw no point in that, since if there was a God, he would not have let this happen. Others said that the conditions at Auschwitz were so horrendous, God chose not to go there. If I prayed for anything, it was to fall asleep quickly without concentrating on my stomach digesting its own lining. So instead, I went through the motions. Line up for appel, line up for work, line up for food, line up for work, march back to the barrack, line up for appel, line up for food, crawl into my bunk. The work I did was not hard, not compared to what some of the other women had to do. We got to step inside from the cold, into the sorting sheds. We hauled suitcases and clothing, but not stone. The most difficult part of my job was knowing that I was the last person who would touch the clothes this person had worn, who would see his face in photographs, who would read the love letters his wife had written. The hardest, of course, were the possessions of little boys and little girls. Toys, blankets, pretty patent leather shoes. No children survived here, They were the first to be sent to the showers. When I came upon their belongings, I sometimes started to cry. It was devastating to hold a teddy bear, because its owner never would again, before tossing it into a pile to be destroyed. I began to feel a great responsibility, as if my mind was a vessel, and I had the duty of keeping a record of those who were gone. We had ample opportunity to steal clothing, but the first thing I stole from Canada was not a scarf or a pair of warm socks. It was someone else's memories. I had promised myself that even if it meant getting a clout on the head from a guard, I would take that extra moment to look at the trappings of a life that was about to be obliterated from existence. I would touch the spectacles with reverence. I would tie the pink ribbons on the knit baby booties. I would memorize one of the addresses in a small leather-bound book of business contacts. The photographs, they were the hardest for me, because they were the only proof that this person, who had owned these undergarments and carried this suitcase, had been alive, had been happy. And it was my job to obliterate that evidence. But one day, I didn't. I waited for the guard to walk away from the row where I was working and opened up a photo album. Written carefully beneath each picture was a caption and a date. In the photos, everyone was smiling. I saw a young woman who must have been the owner of this suitcase smiling up into the face of a young man. I looked at their wedding picture, and at some vacation abroad with the girl mugging for the camera. I wondered how many years ago this had been. Then came a series of photos of a baby, carefully captioned. Anya, 3 days. Anya sits up. Anya's first steps. First day of school. First tooth lost. And then the picture stopped. This child had the same name as the character in my story, which made her seem even more compelling. I could hear the guard yelling at one of the women behind me. Quickly, I popped one of the photos out of the little corner reinforcements that had held it in place. I slipped it up my sleeve. I panicked when the guard came back, certain that he had seen what I did, but instead he just told me to speed up my work. That first night, I went home with pictures of Anya, of Herschel, and Gerda, of a little boy named Chaim missing his two front teeth. The next day I was bold enough to take 8 photographs. Then I was put on a different detail, loading clothes into carts and transporting them to sheds. As soon as I was reassigned to sorting the belongings, I went back to tucking various photos up my sleeve and squirreling them in the straw of my bunk. I didn't see it as stealing. I saw it as archiving. Before I went to sleep, I would take out these photos, this growing deck of the dead, and whisper my way through their names. Anya, Herschel, Gerda, Chaim, Wolf, Mindele, Dvoire, Israel, Shimon, Elke, Rochel and Chaya, the twins, Elias, still wailing after his bris, Shendele on her wedding day. As long as I remembered them, then they were still here. Daria was working next to me, and she had a toothache. I could see her shoulders shaking with the effort of not moaning. If you showed illness, you were an even bigger target than usual for the guards, who took a tiny snag of weakness and ripped it wide open. from the corner of my eye. I saw her lift up a small autograph book with a sequined cover. When we were little, Daria had had one just like it. We would stand outside the theater and fancy restaurants sometimes and wait for glamorous women in white fur coats and silver heels to exit on the arms of their handsome beaux. I have no idea if any of them were actually famous, but they seemed that way to us. Daria glanced furtively toward me and slid the book across the bench. I buried it beneath a coat whose lining I was ripping to shreds. The book was filled with ticket stubs from films and sketches of buildings, the wrapper from a mint candy, and a little poem that I recognized as a hand-clapping game. A hair ribbon, a swatch of tulle from a fancy dress, a winning ticket from a bakery giveaway. Written inside the back cover were two words, "Never forget." Inside the front cover, a photo had been glued of two girlfriends. "Gitele and me," the caption read. I didn't know who "me" was. There was no identifying information, and the handwriting, careful and loopy, belonged to a young girl. I decided I would call her Daria. I looked over at my friend and saw her wipe away a tear with her sleeve. She could have been wondering what became of her own sequined autograph book, or of the happy girl who had once owned it. If I had not seen the transformation myself, I would not have recognized Daria. The long, lithe dancer's body, of which I had been so jealous, was now a bag of bones. Beneath her clothing, the knobs of her spine stood out like fence posts. Her eyes were sunken, her lips chapped dry. She now bit her nails to the point where they bled. I'm pretty sure I looked just as awful to her as she did to me. I ripped out the page with the photograph and tucked it into my sleeve, a move that I now had down to a science. Suddenly, a hand reached over my shoulder and picked up the autograph book. Herr Dibuk stood so close to me that I could smell the pine of his aftershave. I did not turn my head, did not speak or acknowledge him. I heard him rifling through the pages. Surely he would notice the spot in the front where something had been torn out. He moved away, throwing the book onto the heap of items to be burned. But for at least another quarter of an hour, I could feel the heat of his stare on the back of my neck. And that day, I stole nothing else from Canada. At night, Daria couldn't sleep. The pain was so bad. "Minka," she whispered, shivering against me, "if I die, you won't have a picture of me to save." "I won't need one, because you're not going to die," I told her. I knew her tooth was infected. Her breath smelled as if she was rotting from the inside out, and her cheek was swelled to twice its size. If the tooth didn't come out, she wasn't going to survive. I hugged her back to my front, giving her whatever body heat I still had. "Say them with me," I begged. "It will distract you." Daria shook her head. "It hurts, please," I said. "Just try." I did not even need the photos anymore. Anya, Herschel, Gerda, Meyer, Wolf. With each name I spoke, I imagined the face in the picture. Then the thinnest thread of Daria's voice responded, "Mindele?" "That's right. Dvoira, Israel."
"Shimon,"
Daria added.
"Elke."
"Rochel and Chaye." "Elias." "Fischl and Liba." "And Bele." "Lebusch, Moishe, Breina." "Gitele and Daria." By then she had stopped reciting with me. Her body went lax. I checked to make sure she was still breathing, and then I let myself fall asleep. The next day, Daria woke with a swollen, red face, her skin on fire. She couldn't drag herself out of bed, so I had to do it for her, bearing her weight and hauling her to the toilets and then back to the bunk to make our bed. When the beast came in, I was waiting to volunteer to get the gruel because hauling the pot entitled me to an extra ration. I gave it to Daria, who was too weak to even lift the bowl to her mouth. I tried to coax her to open her mouth by singing the way Basha had sung to Meyer when he refused to eat.
"You can't sing," she croaked,
smiling the tiniest bit, and it was just enough for me to get some of the liquid inside. I hauled her upright during appel, praying that the head officer, the one with the shudder in his arm, whom I thought of now as Herr Tremor, didn't notice she was ailing. Herr Tremor might have had some kind of condition that led him to quiver like that, but it wasn't severe enough to keep him from meting out brutal punishment with his own hands. Last week, when a new girl turned left instead of right at his command, he disciplined the whole block. We had to do calisthenics for 2 hours in a cold, driving rain. Needless to say, with so many women starving, at least 10 collapsed. And when they did, Herr Tremor walked through the mud and kicked them where they lay. But today he seemed in a rush. Instead of making an example of us or singling women out for punishment, he hurried through the counting and dismissed the capos. I was on a mission. Not only did I have to cover for Daria and do twice the work, but I had to find something in particular that I could steal, something sharp and small, something capable of knocking out a tooth. I managed to set Daria beside me at the sorting bench and paced myself so that every time she had to bring a valuable to the locked box in the center of the barracks, I had to go too. By the end of the day, though, I had not found a single item that would work. 3 pairs of false teeth, a wedding gown, tubes of lipstick, but nothing pointed and strong. And then, in 1 leather satchel, slipped into a torn silk lining, was a fountain pen. My hand closed around it with an ache. Holding a pen felt so normal that my past, which I had surgically separated from the current state of my existence, came rushing back. I could see myself curled in the window of my father's bakery, writing my book. I could remember chewing on the tip of a pen as I heard the dialogue of Anya and Alexander in my head. The story flowed like blood from my hand. Sometimes it seemed that I was simply channeling a film that was already playing, that I was only the projector instead of the creator. When I wrote, I felt untethered, impossibly free. And right now, I barely remembered what that was like. I hadn't realized how much I'd missed writing in the weeks I'd been here. "Real writers can't not write," Herr Bauer had once told me when we were discussing Goethe. "That is how you know, Fräulein Levin, if you are destined for the life of a poet." My fingers itched, curling around the instrument. I did not even know if there was ink inside. To test it, I pressed the nib against the numbers that had been burned into my left forearm. The ink flowed, a beautiful black Rorschach blot, covering up what they had done to me. I slipped the pen into my jacket. This was for Daria, I reminded myself, not for me. That night I enlisted the help of another girl to prop Daria up at the evening appel. She could barely stand by the time we were sent back to the block 2 hours later. She wouldn't let me even touch her cheek so that I could open her lips and see how bad the infection had become. Her forehead was so hot, it blistered against my hand. "Daria," I said, "you have to trust me." She shook her head, near delirium.
"Leave me alone," she wailed.
"I will, after I knock out that stupid tooth." My comment cut through whatever haze she was in. "Like hell you will." "Shut up and open your mouth," I muttered, but when I went to grab her chin, she reared away.
"Is it going to hurt?"
I nodded, looking her right in the eye. "Yes. If I had any gas, I'd give it to you." Daria started to laugh, faintly at first, and then a loud bark, one that made the other girls turn around in their bunks.
"Gas," she wheezed. "You don't have any gas?"
I realized how silly this was, given the mass extermination that was going on just yards away from our hut. Suddenly, I was laughing, too. It was inappropriate and awful gallows humor, and we could not stop. We collapsed against each other, snorting and hooting, until everyone else got disgusted with us and looked away. When we finally could control ourselves, we had our emaciated arms around each other, the gangly limbs of two tangled praying mantises. "If you can't anesthetize me," Daria said, "then distract me, okay?"
"I could sing," I suggested.
"You want to cause more pain or prevent it?"
She looked at me, desperate.
"Tell me a story."
I nodded. I took the pen out of my pocket and tried to clean it as best I could, which wasn't easy given that my clothes were filthy. Then I looked at my best friend, my only friend. I couldn't tell her a memory from our childhood because that would be too upsetting. I couldn't spin a yarn about our future because we barely had one. There was really only one story I knew by heart. The one I'd been writing, the one Daria had been reading for years.
"My father trusted me with the details of his death," I began, the words rising rote from some deep cave of my mind. "Anya," he would say, "no whiskey at my funeral. I want the finest blackberry wine. No weeping, mind you, just dancing. And when they lower me into the ground, I want a fanfare of trumpets and white butterflies." A character, that was my father. He was the village baker, and every day, in addition to the loaves he would make for the town, he would create a single roll for me that was as unique as it was delicious. A twist like a princess's crown, dough mixed with sweet cinnamon and the richest chocolate. The secret ingredient, he said, was his love for me, and this made it taste better than anything else I had ever eaten. I opened Daria's mouth gently and positioned the pen at the root of her swollen gum. I lifted a stone I had pried from the latrines. We lived on the outskirts of a village so small that everyone knew everyone else by name. Our home was made of river stone, with a thatched roof. The hearth where my father baked heated the entire cottage. I would sit at the kitchen table, shelling peas that I grew in the small garden out back, as my father opened the door of the brick oven and slid the peel inside to take out crusty round loaves of bread. The red embers glowed, outlining the strong muscles of his back as he sweated through his tunic. "I don't want a summer funeral, Anya," he would say. "Make sure instead I die on a cool day when there's a nice breeze, before the birds fly south, so that they can sing for me." I would pretend to take note of his requests. I didn't mind the macabre conversation. My father was too strong for me to believe any of these requests of his would ever come to pass. Some of the others in the village found it strange, the relationship I had with my father, the fact that we could joke about this. But my mother had died when I was an infant, and all we had was each other.
I looked down to see Daria finally relaxed, caught in the gauze of my words. But I realized, too, that the whole hut had gone quiet. All the women were listening to me. "My father trusted me with the details of his death," I said, raising the rock directly above the pen. "But in the end, I was too late." Swiftly, I smashed the stone into the pen, a makeshift chisel. The sound that Daria made was unearthly. She reared up as if she'd been run through with a sword. I fell back, horrified by what I'd done, as she clutched her hands to her mouth and rolled away from me. When she looked up, her eyes were bright red, the blood vessels having burst from the force of her scream. Blood streamed down her chin, too, as if she herself was an upyur after a kill. "I'm so sorry," I cried. "I didn't mean to hurt you." "Minka," she said, through the blood, through her tears. She grabbed my hand, or at least that's what I thought she was doing, until I realized she was trying to give me something. In her palm was a broken, rotted tooth. The next day, Daria's fever had broken. I again carried the breakfast rations from the kitchen so that I could get an extra helping for Daria to build up her strength. When she smiled at me, I could see the gap where her tooth had been, a black chasm. A new woman joined us in the block that evening. She was from Radom, and she had given her 3-year-old to her elderly mother at the loading ramp on the whispered advice of one of the men in striped uniforms. She could not stop crying. "If I'd known," she sobbed, choking on the truth, "if I'd known why he said that, I never would have done it."
"Then you would both be dead," said Esther, the woman who, at age 52, was the oldest one in the block. She worked with us in Canada and had a steady black market business, trading cigarettes and clothing that were pilfered from the suitcases for extra rations. This new woman could not stop crying. That was not an unusual phenomenon, but this particular crier, she was a loud one, and we were all exhausted from lack of food and long hours of labor. We were getting upset listening to her. It was worse than the rabbi's daughter from Lublin, who prayed out loud the whole night through. "Minka," Esther said finally, when this woman had been wailing for hours, "do something."
"What can I do?"
I couldn't bring back her child, or her mother. I couldn't undo what had happened. To be honest, I was annoyed with the woman. That's how inhuman I had become. We had all suffered losses like she had, after all. What made hers so special that it had to rob us of our precious hours of sleep?
"If we cannot shut her up," another girl said, "then maybe we can drown her out."
There was a chorus of agreement. "Where were you up to, Minka?" Esther asked.
At first I did not know what she was talking about, but then I realized that these women wanted to hear the story I had written, the one I had used to calm Daria the night before.
If it worked as an anesthetic, why wouldn't it numb the pain of hearing this mother weep for her baby?
They sat like reeds on the edge of a pond, fragile and swaying slightly against each other for support. I could see the shine of their eyes in the dark.
"Go on," Daria said, elbowing me. "You have a captive audience."
So I started to speak of Anya, for whom the day had started like any other. How it was colder than usual for October, how the leaves had blustered off the limbs of the trees into small cyclones that danced like devils around her boots, which was how she knew that something bad was going to happen. Her father had taught her that, as well as everything else she knew. How to tie her shoes, how to navigate by the stars, how to see a monster who was hiding behind the face of a man. I spoke of the people of the village, who were on edge. Some farm animals had been slaughtered, pet dogs had gone missing. There seemed to be a predator in their midst. I told them about Damien, the captain of the guard, who wanted Anya to marry him, and wasn't above using force to make that happen. How he told the nervous mob that if they stayed within the walls of the village, they would be safe. I had written that part just after moving to the ghetto, when I still believed that. It was quiet in the block. The rabbi's daughter wasn't praying anymore. The new woman's sobs had quieted. I described Damien taking the last baguette Anya had to sell at market, how he held his coins out of reach until she agreed to kiss him, how she left in a hurry with her empty basket and his eyes boring into her back. There was a stream that separated the cottage from the house, I said, speaking in Anya's narrative voice.
And my father had placed a wide plank across it so that we could get from one side to the other. But today, when I reached it, I bent to drink, to wash away the bitter taste of Damien that was still on my lips. I cupped my hands. The water, I said, ran red. I set down the basket I was carrying and followed the bank upstream, and then I saw it.
Saw what? Esther murmured. I remembered in that minute what my mother had told me about being a mensch, about putting others' welfare before your own. I looked at the new woman until she met my gaze. "You'll have to wait till tomorrow to find out," I said. Sometimes all you need to live one more day is a good reason to stick around. It was Esther who told me to write it down. "You never know," she said. "Maybe one day you will be famous." I laughed at that. Or more likely, the story will die with me. But I knew what she was asking. For the narrative to exist, so that it could be read and reread, even if I was taken away. Stories outlive their writers all the time. We know plenty about Goethe and Charles Dickens from what tales they chose to tell, even though they have been dead for years. I think, in the end, that's why I did it. Because there would be no photograph of me for someone to steal or to memorize. There was no family at home anymore to think of me. Maybe I wasn't even remarkable enough to be remembered. Looking like I did these days, I was just another prisoner, another number. If I had to die in this hellhole, and the odds were very good that would happen, then maybe someone else would survive and tell their children the story a girl had told at night in the block. Fiction is like that. Once it is released into the world, contagious, persistent, like the contents of Pandora's box, a story that's freely given can't be contained anymore. It becomes infectious, spreading from the person who created it to the person who listens and passes it on. Ironically, it was the photographs that made it possible. One day, while reciting my litany, I dropped the deck of faces on the floor. Hurrying to gather them again, I realized that some were face down. On the white cardboard of one photo, I read, "Moishe, 10 months." Someone had written that. It was a small square, smaller than what I was used to, but it was paper. And I had dozens of them. And a fountain pen. Having something to live for went both ways. I would play Scheherazade for the block every night, weaving a story of Anya and Alexander until they lived and breathed the way we did. But then I would write by the light of the moon for a few hours to the even snores and occasional whimpers of the other women. To safeguard my work, I wrote in German. If these note cards were ever found, I had no doubt the punishment would be severe, but maybe less so if the guards could read the language and recognized it as a story, instead of thinking they were secret notes to be passed between prisoners to incite rebellion. I wrote from memory, adding bits and pieces as I edited my way through the story, always elaborating on scenes where food was described. I described in the greatest detail the crumb of that delicious roll Anya's father bakes for her. The way she could taste the butter in its flaky crust, the heat that stayed trapped on the soft palate, the burst of cinnamon on the tip of her tongue. I wrote until the fountain pen bled itself dry, until as much of my story as possible was scratched in tiny, careful prose on the backs of over 100 faces of the dead.
Raus!
1 minute I was asleep, dreaming that I had been brought to a room with a table a kilometer long, on which there were heaps of food, and that I had to eat my way from one end to the other before I would be allowed to leave. The next, the beast was smacking the straw of the bunk indiscriminately with a metal rod, her blows landing on my back and my thigh before I managed to scramble down from the perch. Her back was to me, and she was yelling. Several guards filled the block and began to shove women out of the way, yanking the thin blankets off the bunks and sweeping the straw off the wooden planks. They were looking for contraband. Sometimes we knew about an inspection. I don't know how, but rumors would reach us, so that there was time to hide whatever you had squirreled away in your bunk on your person instead. Today, though, there had been no warning. I remembered the novel that had been confiscated weeks ago, the one that led to the injuries that caused Agnat's death. In my bunk, buried under the straw where I had laid last night, was the deck of photos with my story written out. One girl was dragged outside when a guard found a hidden radio. We had been listening to it at night, to Chopin and Liszt and Bach, and once a Tchaikovsky ballet that Daria had danced to in the recital in Łódź, which made her cry in her sleep. Sometimes there would be bursts of news in between, and from these I learned that the German offensive was not going well, that they could not reconquer Belgium. I knew that the United States had continued to advance after landing in France this summer. I told myself it was only a matter of time, surely, before this war was over. If I could survive the moments like this one, anyway. The beast stuck her hand into the straw of the bunk below mine and pulled out what looked like a small rock wrapped in paper. She brought it to her mouth, licked it.
"Who sleeps here?" she demanded.
The five girls who crammed into the tiny space stepped forward, holding tightly to each other's hands.
"Who stole this chocolate?" the beast asked.
The girls looked completely bewildered. It was entirely possible that someone savvier at the last minute had shoved her stash of contraband into the straw of their bunk to save herself. At any rate, they stood mute, staring down at the cold dirt floor. The Blokhelteste grabbed the hair of one of the girls. Like the rest of us who worked in Canada, we were allowed to grow ours out. Mine was about an inch long now. It was only one of the many things about that job assignment that made people jealous. The guards there called us fat swine, because we looked healthier than most of the female prisoners, since we could steal bits of food we found in suitcases.
"Is it yours?" the beast yelled.
The girl shook her head. I didn't...
"Maybe this will jog your memory," she said, and she swung her metal rod across the front of all five of their faces, breaking teeth and noses and driving them to their knees.
She kicked between their fallen bodies to search the straw of our bunk. My heart started up like a machine gun. Sweat broke out on my temples. I saw her hand close around the deck of photographs, which I had secured with a thread pulled from the hem of my uniform dress. As the beast untied the bow, Daria stepped forward. "They belong to me." My jaw dropped. I knew exactly what she was doing, paying me back for saving her life. Before I could speak, another woman stepped forward, too. The one who'd arrived only 3 nights before. The one who could not stop weeping over the loss of her son and her mother. I still did not even know her name.
"She is lying," the woman said. "They're mine."
"They're both lying." I looked at the woman, wondering about her motivation. Was she trying to rescue me? Or just die herself? "She doesn't work in Canada. And she," I nodded at Daria, "does not speak German." One moment I was standing, drenched in bravado, and the next I was being hauled out of the block. It was pouring outside, and the wind raged like a dragon. One of my wooden shoes got stuck in the mud. I had just enough time to grab for it before it got left behind. If you did not have shoes, you would not survive, period. Standing in the center of the courtyard, rain pelting his wool uniform, was the SS officer I called Herr Tremor. There was no shudder in his grasp as he lifted a whip and brought it down on the back of the girl from my block who had hidden the radio. She lay face down in a puddle. After each blow, he yelled at her to get up, and each time she did, he struck her again. I would be next. An uncontrollable shiver ran down the length of me. My teeth were chattering, my nose running. I wondered if he would kill the girl who stole the chocolate. Or me, for that matter. It is a strange thing to contemplate dying. I found myself thinking of the criteria I had once kept for my father as an inside joke. I had criteria of my own now. When I die, please make it fast. If there is a bullet, aim for my heart, not my head. It would be good if it did not hurt. I'd rather die of a sudden blow than an infection. I'd even welcome the gas. Maybe that just felt like going to sleep and never waking up. I do not know when I started thinking of the mass extermination at this camp as being humane. Thinking like the Germans, I supposed. But if the alternative was to waste away to a corpse, as my mind shut down by degrees due to starvation, well then, maybe it was best to just get this over with. As we approached Herr Tremor, he looked up, the rain sleeting across his features. His eyes, I noticed, were like glass, pale and practically silver, like a mirror. "I am not done here," he said in German.
"Should we wait, Schutzhaftlagerführer?" asked the guard.
"I have no intention of standing around all day in this pissing rain because some animals cannot follow rules," he said.
I lifted my chin. Very precisely, in German, I said, "Ich bin kein Tier." I am not an animal. His gaze narrowed on mine. I immediately looked down at my feet. He lifted his right hand, the one holding the whip, and cracked it across my cheekbone, so that my head snapped to the side.
Da irrst du dich.
You are mistaken. I fell to my knees in the mud, holding one hand up to my cheek. The tail of the whip had cut a gash under my eye. Blood mixed with rain, running down my chin. The girl on the ground beside me caught my gaze. Her uniform had been flayed open. The flesh of her back was peeled back like the petals of a rose. Behind me, I could hear conversation. The guards who had brought me here were telling someone else, someone new, what my infraction was. This new officer stepped over me.
Schutzhaftlagerführer, a voice said. You are busy here. With your permission, perhaps I can help you.
I could see only the back of his uniform and his gloved hands, which were clasped behind him. His boots were so shiny that I stared at them, wondering how he could walk through so much mud without getting them filthy. I could not believe that was what I was thinking about the minute before I was to be killed. Herr Tremor shrugged and turned back to the girl on the ground beside me. The other officer walked off. I was hauled upright and taken across the compound, past Canada, to the administrative building where this officer entered. He shouted an order at the guards, and I was brought downstairs to some kind of cell. I heard a heavy lock being snapped into place after the door was sealed. There was no light. The walls and the floor were made of stone. It was like an old wine cellar, slightly damp, with moss that made everything slippery. I sat with my back against the wall, sometimes pressing my swollen cheek to the cool stones. The one time I dozed off, I awakened to the feel of a mouse running up my leg beneath my work dress. After that, I stood. Several hours passed. The cut on my face stopped bleeding. I wondered if the officer had forgotten about me or if he was just saving me for punishment after the rain stopped, so that Herr Tremor could take his time hurting me. By then my cheek had inflamed so badly that my eye was swollen shut. When I heard the door being opened again, I winced at the beam of light that fell into the cramped space. I was brought to an office. Hauptscharführer F. Hartmann, it said on the door. There was a large wooden desk, and many filing cabinets, and an ornate chair, the kind you always found lawyers sitting in. In that chair was the officer in charge of Canada, and spread out in front of him, across the green blotter of his desk and various papers and files, were all of my photographs, flipped onto their bellies to reveal my story. I knew what Herr Tremor was capable of. I saw it every day at Appel. In a way, Herr Dibuk was more frightening, because I had no idea what to expect from him. He was in charge of Canada, and I had stolen from him, and the evidence was displayed between us.
Leave us, he said to the guard who had brought me.
There was a window behind the officer. I watched the rain strike the glass, reveling in the simple fact that I was inside and warm. I was standing in a room where there was faint classical music playing on the radio. If not for the fact that I was probably about to be beaten to death, I would have counted this as the first moment since arriving at the camp that I felt normal.
So, you speak German, he said in his native tongue.
I nodded. Ja, Herr Hauptscharführer.
And you can apparently write it, too?
My eyes flickered toward the photographs. I studied in school, I replied. He passed me a pad of paper and a pen.
Prove it.
He began to walk around the room, reciting a poem.
Ich weiß nicht, was soll es bedeuten, dass ich so traurig bin. Ein Märchen aus uralten Zeiten, das kommt mir nicht aus dem Sinn.
I knew the poem. I had studied it with Herr Bauer, and had once taken an examination on this very dictation, for which I received the highest marks. I translated in my head. I wish I knew the meaning. A sadness has fallen on me. The ghost of an ancient legend that will not let me be.
Die Luft ist kühl und es dunkelt, the Hauptscharführer continued. Und ruhig fließt der Rhein.
The air is cool in the twilight and gently flows the Rhine. Der Gipfel des Berges funkelt, I added under my breath, im Abendsonnenschein. He had heard me. He took the pad and checked my transcription. Then he looked up, staring at me as if I were a creature he had never seen before.
You know this work?
I nodded. The Lorelei. By Heinrich Heine.
Ein unbekannter Verfasser,
he corrected. Anonymous. That was when I remembered that Heinrich Heine had been Jewish.
You realize that you stole material from the Reich, he murmured.
Yes, I know, I burst out. I'm sorry, it was a mistake. He raised his brows. It was a mistake to willfully steal something. No, it was a mistake to think the photographs didn't matter to the Reich. He opened his mouth and then snapped it shut. He could not admit that the photographs were valuable, because that was tantamount to admitting that those who were killed had worth. But he couldn't admit that the photos were meaningless, because doing so would dilute his argument for punishing me.
That is not the point, he said finally. The point is that they do not belong to you.
The officer sank back into his chair, wrapping his